Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects that we all grapple with in this conversation with the reluctant therapist. Happy Healthy Tuesday, Elizabeth.
Happy Healthy Tuesday, Rachel. It's good to be here.
Good to be here, too. What's on your mind today?
Well, we've been talking a lot the last couple months about coping mechanisms, building resilience, how we need to be reaching out for help, even if we have been someone who hasn't really felt that we needed help in the past. You know, what is going on in the world has caused all of us to have to rethink our support systems and our support networks and kind of go beyond our regular comfort zone of sharing our story with friends or going out for a run or taking a yoga class. Like those traditional coping mechanisms that we might have been able to use in the past to help us navigate our lives don't seem to be covering all the bases. And so this week, I want to continue with that theme, the idea that we need to have more arsenal in our caring or self-care capacity than we've used in the past. Because I don't know about you, but I know for myself at this point, 6-7 months into and this level of quarantine or lockdown and, you know, 3 years of feeling everything kind of spinning and being chaotic, my standby or go-to methods for coping, you know, aren't just cutting it all the time. Like I get out and do something physical every day. I make time to talk to people I care about on a regular basis. We have Zoom conversations with my family to touch base. I've tried to spend more time sleeping, getting good sleep, drink more water, you know, those good standard coping mechanisms. But it's become really apparent that I need something more. Like I needed to take my coping and caring up another level. And we talked also about the idea a couple of weeks ago of spreading our seeds towards the future. You know, instead of kind of curling up and going inward and trying to hide out and hoping that all will pass at some point, like the lodgepole pine cone, if you remember that reference, like the lodgepole pine cone that seals itself shut until it feels the heat of an oncoming fire and then explodes open before the fire arrives and spreads its seeds all out on the forest floor. And by the time the fire comes through, those seeds have been planted and a new future has started. And so I keep thinking about that metaphor. I keep thinking about that image that besides my day-to-day self-care, I'm really concentrating on how do I spread those seeds out into my future? How do I start living towards what will be next instead of hiding out in my house, hoping it'll all just go away? And so in those thoughts and conversation, I got an email from my friend and colleague, Dr. Kelly Moreno, and he's been on the show before talking about his book, Duty to Betray. He is a psychologist and a professor of psychology and the director of training for the graduate program at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo. And he said, hey, I put together this album and it's been this really great creative outlet for me. And do you want to talk about it? Because we could talk about the songs and kind of what inspired it. And I thought, yeah, definitely. Because this is a time that we all need to reach more deeply into our creative spaces. You know, maybe tap into those desires that we had years ago that we've been putting on hold and thinking someday I'm going to write that great novel. Someday I'm going to put that poetry down on paper. You know, someday I'm going to get that potter's wheel out again and start creating something, right? How many of those things do we have? Someday I'm going to pull that sewing machine out and actually make that quilt. And that someday is now. That someday of tapping into our inner latent artists and bringing that forth has to happen now, because we need to find other ways to calm our anxious minds. We have to find a way to improve our dampened spirits. We have to find a way to direct this energy that seems to be free-flowing generalized anxiety or anger or frustration or hurt or sadness or grief or all of it all mixed together in one big cauldron. We have to find a way to direct that energy towards love and hope, towards the future, or we're just going to get caught spinning and spinning and spinning and feeling like we're being pulled down further and further. So today my guest is Dr. Kelly Marino, and we're going to listen to some of the music that he's created and put on his album Elsinore, and we're going to talk about the inspiration for those songs, and we're going to talk about that balance between the day job of doing the hard work of tending to the psyches, the mental health and well-being of others, while tending to his own mental health and well-being. And although the phone lines won't be open as we traditionally do, you can still be part of the conversation if you'd like to give us a call to 805-549-8855. You can leave your comment or question, and Rachel will be happy to share it with us on the air, and we'll be able to chat with you that way. If you'd like to send me a message after the show, you can send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. And you can also listen to previous shows at kcbx.org. I'm always happy to have you podcast the show. Just anywhere you look for podcasts, search for A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, hit subscribe, and the show will be uploaded for you to listen to at your convenience. If you can't find your podcast app, ask your kids or your grandkids, because they'll be happy to load it onto your phone. You can listen at any time. And if you can, leave a review so we can share the show with other people. Also, you can follow us on Instagram, Elizabeth_TRT, and on Facebook, The Reluctant Therapist, and you can leave me messages at both of those places as well. So I'm looking forward to seeing where the conversation goes today. I always enjoy a little musical interlude. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. We'll be back in a moment to start the conversation. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And you've been listening to a bit of Back to Missoula from Dr. Kelly Moreno's new album, Elsinore. And I don't know, it doesn't say Dr. Kelly Marino on the front of the cover of the CD. So I'm not sure how we address you in your musician mode. But Kelly, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So that's a rockin' start to the show today.
Yeah, well, thank you. That was the intent, was to start the album with a rocker. And so, yeah, let's rock out a little before we begin, get everything loosened up.
So let's talk about how you got to, you know, adding singer-songwriter. Because I know you've always been a musician and you've played around town, but it seems like this album is kind of special, or the timing around it is special. So let's talk a little bit about what inspired you to do Elsinore now, and then we'll talk about your other credentials. But let's start with the singer-songwriter part and this album.
All right. Well, let me wind it back a bit. It kind of speaks to what you were saying earlier about our day jobs and yet making time for ourselves and finding joy and comfort in other activities and so on. But I'd always been musical, played guitar as a kid and was in a band with my brothers and, played music with my friends in college and graduate school. And then, of course, life just got too busy, put down the guitar. And fast forward 25 years, it's 2010, and I'm just sucking dishwater. My book is at an impasse. I'm teaching full time and chair of the graduate program at Cal Poly. I'm running off to the prisons doing forensic evaluations. I had purchased a commercial building and filled it with a wine shop that I had no business, absolutely no business. I mean, I can barely balance my checkbook, let alone run a business. So I'm going all these different directions. And, meanwhile, I'm watching, our home value and our assets just collapse under the weight of the Great Recession. And I was depressed. I mean, I just was absolutely depressed. And my accountant, who I meet with every year, he says, "God, why don't you come play music with us? Every Sunday we jam in my garage." And I'm like, no. Finally, I was at a friend's house in Cambria for the weekend. And one of my friends is Sherry Geiger, who's now deceased, but a great singer, a great local singer, songwriter, performer. We're there playing around, singing with her and so on. And she's singing this song by Rodney Crowell. And I hear this harmony just kind of wafting from somewhere in the house. I don't know where the hell it's coming from. And it's my friend Fred, who can't sing to save his life. I mean, but he's just singing away. He's singing the harmony as best he can. And in that moment, I thought, I can do that. I can do that. It was just like this epiphany. Why am I not singing? Why am I not playing? And so I went back to my accountant. I said, "Hey, you guys still playing on Sundays?" He says, "Sure." And the crazy uncle who lies down on your couch, to spend the night and then never leaves. I never left. This poor garage band was like stuck with me. I don't know why they didn't kick me out. And so then playing music with them, eventually I started then writing my own. And next thing I know, I've got enough for an album. I met Rob Vermeulen, this fabulous producer in Morro Bay. I can't recommend him highly enough. And he and I put our heads together and spanked this thing out actually just as the COVID crisis was beginning. And that's kind of the cliff notes.
So what of the album, is there, is there a theme to this, to the songs, or does each have its own story? Like, why the title Elsinore, and what about the kind of placement of the songs you chose?
This album really, as Glenn said, Glenn Starkey wrote a piece on this album recently in the New Times, and he says it's a widely varied album, and it is. I mean, there are lighthearted romantic romps like "Get Me Back to Missoula" and "I'd Love to Be Wrong," and then there are other songs that cut way deeper, like "Guns Don't Kill" and "Elsinore," a little Oedipal tale. And so this album is much more varied in terms of styles, rock and roll. There's new wave elements, there's blues, there's Americana folk. The next album is going to be much more, I think virtually every song is going to be more about, in some way or another, mental illness, mental health, recovery, and so on. Whereas this one is, this one's a little more commercial, I think.
And also this one feels to be a little more of the adventurer, the feeling of wanting to get out or get away or, be out in the world. Because "Get Me Back to Missoula," let's start with that because we just listened to a little bit. Are you a Montana guy or what was the...
Well, that's what's funny about the song is I've never been there.
Well, there you go.
No, these several of the guys in this cover band that I'm in with. Cover band, by the way, is called the Tax Band. Great group of people. We have great fun. We play all over town, but they're cover songs, you know. And so a few of us thought we would do a tour up Highway 93, this iconic highway that cuts, you know, a two-lane nasty road, you know, all the way up the Canadian border. And it passes through nice parts of Idaho and Montana, including Missoula. Well, for reasons I won't go into, the tour got shuttered and I was brokenhearted because I was so looking forward to this tour. And I had this song with this cool hook, you know, from the, you know, the guitar riff in that song. And I had the melody, I had the chorus, you know, and I knew the chorus was "Get Me Back to Missoula." It was having something to do with Missoula. I didn't know what it was. But after the tour got shuttered, I thought, well, it's get me back to Missoula. But then it was like, well, how do I get back to Missoula when I've never been, you know? And so as a writer, you know, you never let yourself get blocked by something. You try and work with the obstacle. So it's like, okay, well, let's just free associate, Kelly, you know, if, what would you like to get back to? And I thought, well, I'd like to get back to this young woman, and who might that young woman be? And then it led to thoughts about how my wife and I began courting, and we took a trip to Sedona. And at that time, I was in my early mid-30s. I was still a total wanderer, you know, a real rogue. And I remember on the way back from this trip to Sedona with her, I remember I stopped and I thought to myself, whoa, something different's going on here. And all of a sudden, I didn't want to run off to Washington, D.C., where I was headed next. I wanted to hang with her. So I morphed the two. And I took this, beginning of my relationship with my wife and morphed it into this song called Get Me Back to Missoula. And that's what it's about, this wanderer who all of a sudden meets someone in Missoula and decides now he doesn't want to go. He wants to go back.
That's the place to be. Well, and it's timely as well, because you talked about, as a writer, when you hit an obstacle, you just find a way to move through. And that connects so well to psychotherapy, because right. When people go through their life, we can continue through a lot of stressful things. But at some point, if we hit a block, the challenge is how do we keep moving through and not recoil and move backwards? So it's interesting how you just kind of naturally, with your writing skills, utilize those psychotherapy skills as well.
Right. Well, and you know, this is the stuff of good fiction, of good storytelling. I mean, Joseph Campbell talks about this in The Hero of a Thousand Faces, and I forget his first name, Vogler, who wrote, you know, the Bible for, you know, script writing, and talks about the hero's journey with respect to the hero in films and, you know, what makes someone a hero. And I wrote about this in an article for Professional Psychology. I talked about the therapist's journey as the hero. The therapist runs in and does the client. The client has their own hero's journey. They run into obstacles. But what makes them a hero is the perseverance, the craftiness, the creativity to overcome and figure out a solution, as opposed to passively waiting for someone to come along and make it all better.
And then, of course, at the end of that hero's journey, you're not a hero until you then go back and mentor someone else on their hero's journey, right? That's the completion of the steps.
Right.
So you take all of this wisdom and all these trials and tribulations, and then you turn them out to the world and help someone else along the way.
You hand them the sword.
If you're just tuning in, my guest today is Dr. Kelly Moreno. He is a singer and songwriter of the album we're listening to today, Elsinore. He is also the author of Duty to Betray. And his day job, the way he keeps out of trouble, is working as a psychologist, a professor of psychology at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo. He's also the director of training for their graduate program. And he also goes in, he works for the Department of Corrections on doing dangerousness. You're going to have to describe this for me, but doing assessments to figure out the dangerousness for parolees who are going to be getting released from prison. And I would imagine there's a lot of heaviness to all of that work. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And you can always be part of our conversation if you have a question or comment by giving us a call at 805-549-8855. And so, Kelly, let's talk a bit about the day job piece. And because, you know, as a singer and songwriter, author now as well, how did becoming a psychologist and doing this work in the prisons become your primary work as opposed to following the artist path?
As a kid, I never thought of myself as creative. I really didn't. It wasn't something I was told. I figured if I couldn't paint or draw well, you know, and I could only make stick figures, that I just simply wasn't creative. And I didn't start really sensing that until my graduate advisor started telling me that I was a good writer and that I was a creative writer. And even then, in graduate school, it was so ego alien, you know, it was just so foreign to me. It was hard to digest. But I found that after I got my PhD, and I had no interest in being an academic, when I went into psychology, it was just like, I even told the University of Utah, I says, I'll come here, but I ain't being no academic when I'm done here.
You won't see me as a professor.
I want to be a clinician. And they just kind of chuckled and took me anyway, bless their hearts. But after I left the University of Utah, I was working full-time at Camarillo State Hospital and then Cottage Hospital on their eating disorders and chemical dependency unit. And I just found that the longer I did the work, the more ideas I had about how to teach, you know, because teaching, you know, is just always the same lecture, discussion, test, lecture, discussion, paper. And our medical director at the time was this real iconoclast named Dr. Lunianski. And every week he said, you know, instead of a traditional staff meeting, you guys are all going to sit in this room, and I'm going to sit in this room with a patient, and you're going to watch me do therapy with this woman for as long as she's here. And we did that, and, you know, it was just great to watch him just do his thing and make mistakes all over the place. And then afterwards, despite how cocksure he was so welcoming and so tolerant and so inclusive and so inviting for us to think about our own ideas and what we would have done, et cetera. I was so moved by that because that's not how I was raised. There was my parents' way and the wrong way, right? And so I thought, God, wouldn't it be fun to teach and use films or do demonstrations in front of the class like he did, diagnostic interviews, therapy interviews, do groups with the students instead of just, you know, read the book, you know. Right. And that's what motivated me to apply at Cal Poly. And since then, in fact, I've got a paper that one of these days I'm going to finish called, you know, Cal Poly is Learned by Doing. And this paper that I'm working on is called Teach by Doing, where we do the work, we show our students the work. Mm-hmm. And there's just a ton of creativity in that, you know, and also learning storytelling, studying short and long form fiction, you know, back before I did my novel has also made me just a better storyteller. And in class, it's just terrific fun. Instead of saying, okay, well, the defense mechanisms are, you know, and then just ripping them off, you know, the definitions, starting out with a story, you know, like, once there was this woman who had this chronic problem of warts on her feet. That gets people's attention. Warts on her feet. You know, and they know it's a psychotherapy story, so they know she's got to get better. So they're hooked, you know, they're in. And then you can tell the story and then go back. Now that they have this visual, then you can go back and talk about psychosomatization, you know, and the ways in which emotional conflicts are channeled into the body and so on. So you get my point. There just was all kinds of room for creativity the older I got and the more reinforcement I got for it, you know.
Well, and it's interesting because I think a lot of, I mean, they call psychotherapy the art of psychotherapy. It's rarely referred to as the science of psychotherapy. So at its heart, the work that we do is an art form. And so there is a pulling of that creative piece. But I also think we have to be able to tap into that creativity so we can make space for our clients to also feel safe tapping into their own creativity. Because I guess when I, at the top of the show, I talked about how those old coping mechanisms that we've all been able to get by with, you know, when life is regular, aren't quite working for everyone at this point. So from a clinical standpoint, you know, how would you help people who are finding that yoga or their spin class or, you know, going for a jog isn't quite filling them or helping them calm themselves? How would you help them tap into the muses as you've tapped into your muses? You know, people who would say, oh, I'm not creative in that way.
Well, that's a tough one. But I, and you may not like this answer very much, but really I depending on the person, in some cases, I don't know that I would necessarily try and change their thinking about things. I think the most therapeutic thing to do is recognize, as our wonderful president likes to say, it is what it is. And sometimes I think the way out of something is simply through it. That's an old Robert Frost line. And if they're struggling right now, if they're having difficulty, they should be. I mean, these are extraordinary times. These are oppressive times. They're incredibly limiting times. And so I think for some people, just giving themselves permission to suffer and to not be have their A game right now is actually, you know, a lift, is a way out almost. Now, that said, at the same time, I find the word that's really most, it's even more useful than creativity, is joy. Where is the joy? You know, where is it? And that, and again, without knowing who exactly specifically is in front of me, I would be on the hunt for that.
And isn't it interesting, because that is, I think students give a lot of pushback to psychology professors, because every time they ask us a question, our response is always, it depends.
Right.
Right? There's never that direct answer. It's like, it depends. And then I'll give you a few ways that it depends might play out.
Right.
But as far as, you know.
But can I speak to that just for a second?
Yes, please do.
I think just that in and of itself, the idea of it depends, I think that's one of our biggest developmental tasks as adults, is to be able to tolerate ambiguity. We just hate that. And the inability to tolerate ambiguity, I think, is at the heart of so many problems, or it certainly is a factor, you know? So to tell people it depends is not just some like dodgy way of answering a question. It really just depends. And life's not clear cut. There are no guarantees. It isn't black and white. You know, it's not as predictable as we'd like to think, or as some people suggest. You know, I don't know if I should have said that.
Carry on, move through.
Stuff happens.
Yeah. Well, and.
Sorry.
No, and I think that is the challenge in psychotherapy, and this is going in a different direction, but this idea that there is, you know, you can apply tools to every person and then have an outcome, you know, as if we're going to be able to, someone comes in and they're struggling and we pull out our book and say, oh, here's what we need to do. You know, it's not like that. I mean, we're more like alchemists than really... Right. Having a specific tool. And I think that is, to me, the beauty of psychotherapy, because everyone is able to tap into whatever their story is, whatever that might be. Right. But also it's frustrating because people don't have the patience for how long it takes to let their own story unfold, or they feel like there should be more science behind it, or why am I paying you money? You know, I think there's a lot of that is the conundrum of mental health care.
Right.
Because it's not direct.
Right. I tell my students, psychology is a science, psychotherapy is an art.
Yes.
It's a craft, you know, and science, you know, the science of psychology can guide the craft, can inform the art. But when we get in there and we're working with someone, there is no manual. You know, I mean, really, that's just so insulting to the person. And it just takes all of the mystery you know, out of life. And all of our lives are a mystery.
Which is then, again, what makes it so beautiful to be human.
And a curse.
Exactly.
Right?
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to my guest, Dr. Kelly Moreno. He is a psychologist, professor of psychology at Cal Poly, and the director of training in the grad department. He is also the author of Duty to Betray, but today he's my guest because he is a singer-songwriter for a new album, Elsinore, and we're talking about kind of that creative muse and where it comes from and how he's taken this next part of his life, and say second wave of his life, but it could be the third or fourth wave, to create his identity as a singer-songwriter. And so let's take a quick break and listen to another song from Elsinore. This is called Day Job by Kelly Moreno. And you're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. We'll be back in a moment.
This town just not the same. Here's crowd and noise. His house is way too big. He won't ever pay it off. Just pack it up, sell it all and go live. Touch all seven and sail the seas, the travel driven life. But he got a day job, no more working at night. And he got his weekend all alone. Oh, he really can bang them drums. Can he sing the blues? And he tells a good story. He can pen a book or the news. But he got a day job. Pension, no need to say.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, and I'm here with my guest, Kelly Moreno, and that's one of the songs from his new album, Elsinore. The song is called Day Job, and it goes well with our topic today about finding that creative source and still managing to maintain our lives, our regular day jobs. So, Kelly, let's talk about that song. Break it down for me a little bit.
Well, that song actually came to me back in 2010 before I even got back into music. It was about 2 years before I got into that cover band. We were in Berkeley, and one night, this is just how our minds work. One night in the middle of the night, I wake up and I have this tune in my head, and I had these words about a day job and no more working at night, and he loves his weekends and home with his wife, and he likes his Blue Cross and his 401k. And and I'm thinking, whoa, I mean, like, where is this coming from? Because I hadn't written a song in my life, you know? But again, as a writer, I knew better. And I thought, okay, well, I'm going to write this down. I don't know what I'm going to do with it. And I didn't do anything with it. For 5 years, it just kind of sat there in a file. And then by 2015, I was in this cover band, and I'd been playing with this cover band now for 3 years. And that cover band was an awakening. I mean, it truly was getting back into music, playing with them every Sunday. And then we got out and started gigging around town, which was just a total rush. I mean, that is just so fun, you know? But then it was tax season 2015. My accountant, who's
He's coming into the stories.
He does. His name is Rob Cruttenden. And, maybe you're listening, Rob.
Rob is your muse.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, at this time, he was an SOB because he said, well, we got to take a three-month break because of tax season. I'm thinking, WTF, man. What about the previous tax seasons? You know, why didn't we take a break then? And he says, well, we got to take a break for here. And I, at that point, you know, playing music was just a lifeline. And so it was like, oh, my God, what am I going to do now? And just from that position of, again, we're of a vacuum, it was like waiting to see what comes next, what bubbled up. And I just thought about that song and those lyrics, and I pulled them out. And also my daughter was going off to college, and I was grieving in advance. And I thought about, okay, well, if I can't play music with the band, and meanwhile, I would kind of doodle on my guitar and basically started writing. I wrote several songs about my grief about her leaving, but then remembered these lyrics regarding this day job in my filing cabinet. And because there's always this, for me, there's always been this constant tension between the more dreamy aspects of life and running off to be a writer, or, you know, start a wine business or travel the world, you know, or sail the seas, you know, or just become a, you know, full-time singer, whatever, writer, you know, just being, and, the fact is, no, I got this great day job, pays the bills, got retirement, health, and it's a, you know, it's good. I like it, you know, but it's also anchoring, you know, it's anchoring and it's limiting, you know, and there's that tension between, you know, taking care of business and yet at the same time still finding room in our lives for joy. You know, it's like you were saying earlier, you know, we have good family, good relationships, good jobs, but still sometimes it can feel like something's missing, you know, and that's where it's kind of like find the joy. And that's what this song was for me, was kind of dealing with that tension, because at the end of the song, the guy basically dies before he finds his joy, you know?
So it's a cautionary tale in the song.
Cautionary tale. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, the last line of the song is good thing he waited to do what he wanted then. You know, and so that's kind of the story behind that song. But there's a friend of mine, a gifted poet named Val Krupp-Noop. She said it's a great example of the golden handcuffs, you know. And I think that, again, it's one thing, we're grateful for what we've got, and yet sometimes we can still need more. And there's a whole lot of wisdom in knowing, you know, how far to go with that and if and or when.
Well, and I like that aspect of the story writing, the songwriting in some ways as a act of journaling or a way of journaling, because as therapists, you and I, I'm sure, are often telling our clients, journaling would be really helpful for you. And then they look at us with that glazed over face of like, I don't want to journal. Like, nobody really likes to journal. But the songwriting piece, because in that writing of that song, you almost had a full kind of resolution of that conflict, right? You know, and so what a great outlet to maybe encourage people who, you know, don't want to journal and don't feel like they can, you know, sit down and get their thoughts on paper, just to allow just the riffing of lyrics that go through their head to come out as kind of a creative gripe.
Yeah.
And see where the creative gripe takes us.
Yeah, or just whatever. You know, it's like I was thinking, you know, we talked during the break about just, you know, the various ways in which we can find some piece of ourselves. And it's amazing sometimes how little it takes. We can have a week filled with a 40-hour week job, another 40 hours taking care of our kids and our various other responsibilities. But if we can find, really, it's remarkable, sometimes just a sliver every week where we have the opportunity to do that thing that offers some degree of joy, it's remarkable what a lift that can put in our shoe.
You know? And so let's talk about that too, just from a clinical standpoint, you know, because people will say, I don't have an extra hour a day, or I can't carve it up. When you talk about just a little sliver and someone's listening, what would be a start? You know, how much time?
Well, for me, it's just like listening to them talk when I think about the clients in front of me. Mm-hmm. Here's something that just came to mind. And let me just play with the details a little bit for confidentiality and anonymity. But there's a group I used to run, and someone would come to the group periodically, and clearly wasn't, you know, a very happy fellow. But when he would check in with the group and talk, he would brighten up whenever he talked about smoking with God.
And what did that mean?
Instead of saying, you know, you're hallucinating, you know, that's a delusion, whatever, it was like, really? I didn't even know God smoked. Oh yeah. And now he's sitting up in his chair. He says, yeah, he smokes Marlboro. And I'm like, no kidding. That's what I used to smoke. I said, how long has he been smoking? And he's like, oh man, the guy's been around forever. He was smoking since he created the universe. Is that right? Well, so like, what do you guys do when you smoke together? He said, we just kick back on the porch and we smoke and we just talk. And what do you talk about? And so, and in that moment, he is joyful, you know, he is happy. And moreover, he's got someone. And of course, some of the other people in the group are looking at me like, what the heck?
You're losing control.
But no, the purpose, of course, is to make contact, with him and engage with him and take as seriously these things that he's talking about that as he does. And the point is, I saw glimmers of joy in his face, of happiness. And then once he saw I was taking him seriously, then he really lit up. And so that might be kind of a far out example, but if we just pay attention, maybe it's cooking, maybe it's quilting, you know, maybe it's gardening, but you know, when someone asks, you know, what can I do? I'd ask the question back. Well, you know, and if you weren't burdened by X, Y, and Z, what would you do? Well, I am burdened by X, Y, and Z. Well, okay, let's just pretend they're not, but I am. Well, let's pretend you're not. I mean, just, you know.
And it's either that I am burdened, or I think behind the I am burdened story is a lot of fear of, I don't know what I would do if I had the extra time. And that's what I think I hear a lot as well. You know, I am anxious because other people have passions and I have no passions. And so that's that other stopping point. And so I kind of like to challenge listeners and my students, and I'd like to hear your thoughts, you know, to think about when you were young, you know, pre-adolescence, even when you were as far back as you can remember, there were things you did just because they were joyful, because they were fun. And at some point someone said, you shouldn't be doing that anymore, right? It's not going to get you anywhere, or you're not really that good. And to go back to those things that you enjoyed before someone told you had to stop and revisit them.
Right. Yeah. I was going to be Sandy Koufax and John Lennon, baseball and music. I mean, that's all that I cared about. And I heard, oh, don't be silly. You can never be a professional baseball player. You can never be a professional musician, blah, blah, blah. But I mean, as a kid, despite really how pathological all of the families I was in were, nonetheless, you know, baseball was a through thread. It was something that gave me a terrific diversion from the chaos, and it was joyful. Music did the same thing. And so I'm grateful I had that. And despite what people said, I made time to do it, you know?
If you're just tuning in, this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and my guest today is Dr. Kelly Marino. Today, he's here as a singer and songwriter of the album Elsinore. He's also the author of the book Duty to Betray. And his day job, he is a psychologist, a professor of psychology at Cal Poly, the director of training for the master's program, and also works for the Department of Corrections. And so you have a lot of roles and identities, but it's interesting, you can, you know, get back to the joy piece of baseball and music. And you said something that really caught me, and it's this response that adults tend to always give, which is, you can't make a living doing that. So that is silly. Like, why have we told the story that unless we can make a living doing something, it's not worth our time? And maybe as parents, we need to really rethink that feedback, because maybe everything's not about making a living. You know, maybe the making a living is just a sliver of our life, and we should focus on all the things that won't make a living, but actually make our life worth living.
Well, you know, I think so much of this is generational too. You know, if you think about our people our age, you know, our parents were, you know, depression babies, you know, and so for them, you know, making a living was to survive. And, you know, and so I can see why that was the number one message. And just evolutionarily, you know, I mean, to, you know, like Karl Marx said, food, shelter, and clothing, you know, those things come first. And everything else comes after that. So I think there's a strong, you know, kind of like evolutionary pull for that security. And again, I do think there's a generational factor. But what's unfortunate is that, once again, these false dichotomies, that it's one or the other. And life is, like I was talking about earlier, you know, life is just so much richer than that. You know, there is so much in addition. There's so much in between those two extremes that we can be doing. Maybe we can gamble and make a career of it. Maybe it is an avocation. It is a hobby. It's a time out. But I was thinking about, I was thinking also while you were speaking that, again, when people talk about they don't have anything, they don't have any passion, they don't know, you know, again, my experience is that people leak.
Explain that.
That they leak, you know, they'll say that they don't have this, that, or the other thing. And then they'll say, but God, you know, the other day I was out walking my dog on the beach and he was just going crazy chasing the ball. And they just, their affect brightens, their cheeks get rosy. You can see their teeth, you know, and they're just laughing and smiling. And it's like, oh, wait a second here. This sounds fun. This sounds joyful. Oh yeah, but it's just walking my, you know, I mean, so, you know, people need to be pushed sometimes too, you know, and don't get me wrong. I know that there are some people with remarkably impoverished lives. They just never, there were, if there were seeds in there to begin with, and some people, they just never were planted. Maybe there were seeds, they just never got watered, and that becomes, you know, part of our job as psychotherapists is, you know, in a longer term therapy is to cultivate those things and help them grow, you know. But other people, those joys are there. They're just hidden, or they're not being taken seriously. They're being dismissed. The person is doing to themselves that same negative chatter that they grew up with. It sounds like you're treating yourself right now the same way that your parents told you when you said you really enjoyed being with animals. What about that? And all of a sudden, you know, now they're spending a day of the week at the humane shelter.
And it is, it's the intentionality behind the joy, because we have to recognize it. You know, cooking is a great example, because I don't really enjoy it, but I know my girls both really get great pleasure out of it. And so I try to consistently, lovingly say, this is art, what you're creating, and it's love that you're creating. And if you say that, it's just a little mantra. I make this food because I love my family. If you just say that mantra, it gives that action, that activity, more weight in your psyche. And so when you take the dog for a walk on the beach and they're chasing the ball, just for a moment, if you use this mantra, I do this because I get joy being with my dog, right? It has greater weight.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and in that way, you are talking to yourself, treating yourself now differently than just these edicts that were handed to you, you know, and that when we're youngsters, we just gobble up because we don't know any better.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit more about the writing process and that awakening, because there was a period of time. I mean, you and I've worked together now for over 10 years. So we've both launched our children and cried on each other's shoulder at school and, you know, moved a little bit towards retirement. And at one point you were moving towards retirement and then pulled back and kind of reinvested yourself in school. But then the writing picked up. How do you see your life moving forward from this point? You know, where do you see your path right now? What's next for Kelly Marino?
Funny that you should ask that.
Okay.
Well, the fact is, I did enter this pre-retirement, for lack of a better word, program at Cal Poly. So I am now, you know, allegedly doing less than I was before, but I am sure not finding that to be the case. And so actually this got my wife. Geez, she, poor thing, she hears this every day. God, I was doing this. I just didn't have the time to do that. Every day it just seems like I don't get anything done. Blah, 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 blah. Wah, 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 right? But I do think I've got to let go of some more. I mean, I'm not, you know, I'm not 55 or 45 or 35. I just can't, you know, have as many things in the air and juggle them successfully without dropping anything. And I don't want to, you know, work at that pace. And so, and I am for sure committed to making sure that I've got time every week to continue writing. I've got another album that I'd love to get back in the studio and record, but I got to launch this one first, which, as an aside, that's a total drag. I mean, man.
So you like the creating, but not the promoting.
Oh my God, all this social media stuff and SoundCloud and CD Baby and Spotify and Amazon. Like, oh, jeez, this is so not me, you know. But anyway, I'd love to record another album. I've got a concept album that I'd love to be able to do. I still have a second book that just is one rewrite, you know, from being ready to go. So that kind of stuff I would like to continue to do. But I'm going to have to kind of clear a little more off my plate in order to do it. On the other hand, you know, got some, you know, bills to pay, you know, like that I talk about in day job, you know. So there's that tension of meeting the responsibilities. And there's also a certain lifestyle that we've gotten used to. You know, in all fairness, you know, I've got to recognize that as well. So. But I would be very unhappy if I didn't create the time to create. And so that is in order.
Is it difficult for you to start moving away from the active work as a psychologist and helping people? And, you know, I mean, I just know for myself, I feel a sense of responsibility because I have these skills that I need to be sharing them. Do you feel that way?
I feel that way big time. I'm just aware of this quarter. Normally I would be teaching the first year graduate students individual theory and practice. And you know, that's where the gold is just in those attachments that we make with our students and then watching them grow over the course of 2 years. So I am missing some things. I'm missing the goodies that come with, you know, being in the classroom and just the energy and the excitement that goes with the exchange of ideas and discovery that we just see their young minds just popping, you know, as we play with these concepts and illustrate them and so on. And then I'm definitely doing fewer hours of psychotherapy than I used to. And there is a part of me that's, I'm glad you mentioned that responsibility. I too feel like, we've got something, you know, it's not just a skill, but we also have, you know, 30, 40 years of doing it. Mm-hmm. And people, you know, there's people that would benefit by that. Yeah. So that, yeah, that's a,
it's a, I find it as a conundrum. It's a dance of, loving my freedom, but feeling a sense of responsibility to something greater than myself.
Right.
And it's there. And so, Kelly, as we start to wrap up, I'm going to finish the show today with Morning Lullaby, and it's M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G. Talk a little bit about that song before we play it.
Well, I'm glad you asked. That's a song I wrote for my stepmother after my father died 3 years ago. And, you know, she's 85 years old, and they had a 40-year love affair, and she just was crestfallen. I mean, she was just shattered. And so she just complained just regularly, routinely, about how much she missed him. And she reminisced about all they did together and just was bleeding grief, you know. And I noticed that after 6, 8, 12, 15 months, you know, she just continued. And I was struck by the number of people in my family or in the social circle that started to think, okay, you need to be over it. You know, get over all Phyllis does is, you know, talk about Joe, my dad, you know, how much she missed him and so on. And it was just like, no, you know, the depth of the despair is always in direct proportion to the gravity of the attachment. Mm-hmm. And they had an incredibly intense attachment. And so, you know, I've seen this in other people who are grieving. Sometimes they need to hold on to that pain. They need to hold on to it because without it, there is no one left. It becomes a way symbolically of holding on to the person. And I just find that so fascinating. And I also find it, as speaking of creativity, the mind is a remarkably creative thing. And these things we call pathology, like complicated grief, et cetera, and so on, or even psychosis, you know, actually can be ingenious solutions to problems for which we have no other solution. And she still holds on, and I think she needs to, and I don't begrudge her one bit of it.
This song is called Morning Lullaby. It's on the album Elsinore, and you can get this album.
Boo Boo Records has it. Grand Central has it. It's on, you can buy, I don't know, this is where I like fall on my face. You can buy the songs, you can buy the album on Amazon. I'm working with this promotion guy to like figure out how to do this other part.
You can always send me an email to Elizabeth at thereluctanttherapist.com, and I'll put you in touch with this album, Elsinore. The song is Morning Lullaby. Kelly Moreno, thank you for your time. And thank you all for listening and supporting Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
Like a tree deep in the wood, who will hear you when you fall? Who will see you when you're down? Now that there's no one around, for the cane has no hand to hold, the chair's weak.